Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com. Co-hosting with me is Richard Latterman, Portfolio Manager at Resolve Asset Management. Richard, it's great to see you.
Yeah, good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So, Richard, today we're joined by one of our favorite and popular guests, the ever insightful and often provocative head of the Doomberg Collective, known for their ability to cut through the noise and dive deep into the structural underpinnings of our economy, geopolitics, and energy markets. Doomberg has become a trusted voice for those questioning mainstream narratives. From the vulnerabilities facing global powerhouses like Germany and Taiwan, to the role of energy as the true backbone of national strength, to the skepticism surrounding technology hype and institutional agendas, Doomberg brings a no-nonsense perspective that's equal parts cautionary and revelatory.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Doomberg, welcome. It is great to have you back on the show and to catch up with you.
Pierre, Richard, after that introduction, I hope I can follow through.
Well, you're a household name and you're definitely the most popular green chicken on the web. So we are very happy to have you.
We set the bar low around here, yeah.
Absolutely.
Lots to talk about today. We're waking up. We're recording this on November the 6th morning after, well, pretty much guaranteed Trump victory, right? It's been confirmed. I don't think there's been a concession yet from the Democrats, but it seems like he will be the next president of the U.S. I think maybe the first question is, how does that change your perspective on the energy landscape for the U.S. and perhaps how that spills over into energy policies more globally?
I think it's unquestionably a bearish development for energy equities, in our view. I think it is bullish for energy supply. Drill, baby, drill is not just a cliche. I think there will be a huge pair of scissors taken to the administrative state / regulatory regime at the federal level. And I think there's going to be an army of conservatively oriented pro-business people in and around the administration. And I think that's just the new reality. You know, whatever your views of the election, I think we try our best to be agnostically analytical about what we're seeing on the tape. And I think the EPA under Harris would have imposed upon the industry discipline that it is incapable of imposing upon itself. And so when given the opportunity to drill, they drill. And that's what we see on the board. You know, I wouldn't read too much into today's sort of market moves, that you're seeing a huge move in the dollar and corresponding drop in gold. I think all this stuff will equilibrate over time. It is a bit bizarre that we've not seen a concession. I think the victory was pretty pronounced. And I think, you know, the Republicans are in a way at a dangerous moment because they'll have the presidency, they'll have the Senate. Looks like they're going to have the House. They have the Supreme Court. Now you got to govern. And you've got to be held accountable. There's really no excuses for not implementing what the people who voted for you want done. It's going to be a challenge. Often in these situations, we see an elastic rebound in the midterms. So I think they'll have a limited window to push through some pretty significant reforms. But, you know, Donald Trump is a man who likes the numbers to go up. And so I think it's inflationary. And I think that that'll be somewhat offset by cheaper energy prices. But for the energy complex in particular, you wouldn't want to be long the producers, maybe some service providers or other enablers of production growth. But in our view, all things being equal, it's pretty bearish for energy equities.
And with the appetite for drill, baby, drill, is that necessarily, can we be as simplistic as to say that this is necessarily bad for nuclear in the sense that the sense of urgency that one would need to change the regulatory landscape and to allow for more development of nuclear power plants in the U.S., would that necessarily become a bit of a hindrance?
No, we'd be pretty bearish nuclear. I think the big tech companies need it. Big tech companies want it. I think the FERC decision on that co-location, nuclear power plant co-location deal has stirred the pot a little bit. We're pondering penning an open letter to President Trump on energy, and one of the five recommendations was the desperate need to reform the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I think he'll probably get that done. And I think big tech just needs nuclear. By the way, our view on AI and nuclear and natural gas is that we're going to see off-grid. These co-locations that are connected to the grid are not going to get approved because AI will put a strain on the average consumer's electricity bill that will be unacceptable to politicians. And also getting federal approval just takes longer. And so I think we're going to see self-contained power-producing facilities with data centers attached to them that aren't connected to the grid. And power in the form of either natural gas or uranium goes in the front end, and data comes out the back. And I think this rejection by FERC is a big deal. But I think long-term it's actually bullish because it'll speed up what needs to get done, which is sort of off-grid pods, as we call them, of, you know, energy goes in and data comes out.
Reading your piece on the FERC rejection, it was just interesting to see that you know, they're more concerned, like the regulators are more concerned with, you know, the data centers, like Amazon, for example, on the Talon Energy connection, having to compete with consumers on pricing. So
yeah, so the what's electricity worth? It's worth way more than the average consumer pays for it, which is a bit of a mirage because it's a deeply subsidized public good. And so this rally in the utility stocks was always a bit of a head scratcher to us because there's no scenario in which Joe Sixpack is going to pay 50% more for their electricity through one election cycle. And so I think there's a bit of a mirage because the more people use, the more they pay, but that's not really a market, right? You're just paying a fixed price for an underpriced good that is managed that way by design. And you can't inject 3, 4, 5, 8, 10% electricity demand onto the slowest developing, most complex electricity grid in the world without having major disruptions. So the price elasticity demand for electricity is amongst the highest of the quote unquote commodities. And so it has to go offline. And I think they'd want it to go offline because if you just park a bunch of gas turbines in the Permian, off you go. You don't need FERC. You don't need anything. You need the Texas Railroad Commission, but that they're pretty pliant as far as regulators go. So I think that's the solution. The quicker everybody recognizes that and stops waiting 6 to 9 months to get rejected by some federal regulator over, again, their rejection basis was both cost and grid stability. The grid is very unstable, too. And so if you add this increment of demand to it, I think you're putting politicians in a, like, they're not used to this. They're not dynamic. They're not innovative. They don't operate at Google speed or NVIDIA speed. And so it has to be done offline in our view. And by the way, there's going to be opportunities for people who enable that in a big way.
Yeah. And I can't help thinking about, you know, Trump's assertion that, you know, he killed the Mexico auto deal, you know, Mexico auto construction projects because of tariffs, because just simply the Chinese are afraid of the tariffs they're going to have to pay even through, you know, through bypassing through Mexico. But, you know, that surge in economic activity in Monterrey, for example, where, you know, the auto plants are up and coming, large auto global auto manufacturers are building their base there. A lot of that is being driven by cheap natural gas exports from the U.S. And so if the growth of the Monterrey automotive manufacturing base is hurt by the Trump election, that means that all that cheap natural gas, some of it is going to have to be, you know, taken up here, right? I mean, domestically.
Yeah, I think he's going to threaten tariffs. I think that
not actually go through with it. Yeah,
I think that's going to be his main stick in the immigration issue to get Mexico's cooperation on sealing the border. I don't think we'll go through with it. There's some complications with NAFTA. I mean, I think wouldn't we have to break that agreement? And I think the U.S. oil and gas industry needs that outlet. And if we constipate the flows to Mexico, then we can't produce in the Permian, right? I mean, that's one of the main outlets that allows the co-production of oil and gas in the Permian to occur in the first place. And Trump wants cheap gas prices. And so we got plenty of gas. Yeah. You know, there's no worries about. Well, I mean, we got more than we know what to do with, especially if we have a mild winter, which is certainly starting out to be. So I would say that they will cut a deal.
Yeah,
I think. And the big automakers need Mexico. I mean, there's a lot of economic activity. I think we're going to see an industrial boom in the southern U.S. I mean, there's just no question about it. I think you can't have the world's cheapest, abundant supply of the world's cleanest burning hydrocarbon for as long as we've had it, with a pro-trade, pro-reshoring president, with a military-industrial complex that desperately needs to get a supply chain act together. Even though I think we're going to see the end of the war in the Ukraine, we can get to that. There's still a lot of restocking that has to be done. The Pentagon has depleted its inventory of advanced missiles. China makes a lot of this stuff. We just saw China stop the sale of an important battery for our drone maker. There's going to be a rush of economic activity. I think by and large, next 2 years are going to be boom times in the U.S. South.
Yeah, wow. Just to pull on the thread of the military-industrial complex's ability to produce. I think we might have touched on this on the last time I spoke to you, but this is something I've been following over the last several months. The fact that Russia has been able to outproduce the combined West in artillery shells and some other basic warfare materials and munitions, what does that say about the West's readiness for this, you know, what seems to be a growingly dangerous place, like an ever more dangerous place on a global scale?
Well, I think, first of all, it speaks to the deep technical arrogance of Western analysts, which we have been raising our hand and objecting to from the very beginning of the conflict in Ukraine. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a certain popular YouTube character who we all know saying that, you know, Russian oil and gas would stop and their economy was going to collapse and there's no engineers and they need our services companies. Like this can only be spoken by somebody who's never worked in industry. I mean, China, India, and Russia, who are all highly motivated to keep those molecules flowing, are the at the pinnacle of engineering. There's an entire university in China that produces nothing but petroleum engineers. And I think they have 15,000 students enrolled there. We produce 600 a year. I mean, to think that Russia, which is a deeply scientific, centuries-old culture, very strong manufacturing base, we confuse, you know, we quoted Luke Roman in a recent piece, he had a great line, like, let's not confuse commodity GDP with house-flipping GDP, because they're just not the same thing, right? I mean, Russia is outproducing NATO. And look, Russia's got a corrupt military. We have a corrupt military. Where's that $900 billion going? I mean, let's look inward for a bit and see where all that money is going. I mean, a lot of it's going into stock buybacks for the big military-industrial complex companies. Look, yeah, Russia's going to win that war. We'll see what the election of Trump does. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But to think that Russia, which, by the way, has a history of marching from east to west and carpet bombing their way as far as they feel like going. This is not the first time they've done this. We're fighting a war where our supply chain starts in China, comes to the U.S. and goes to Ukraine. They're fighting a war where their supply chain is 50 miles behind the line of contact. I mean, this is always folly. And, you know, I remember we were among the first to point out that the sanctions were designed to backfire. And they did. They have. The Russian economy right now, the main problem they have in Russia right now is that the economy is overheating. They're worried about inflation. You know, and so. Like it's high, and one of the reasons you don't get into wars is you might lose them. And this is where we are. So I'm going to be very fascinated to see whether Trump and Putin speak and what comes of it. But a lot of pieces on the chessboard moved last night. For the record, I'm just relieved that it was a decisive victory.
Right.
And that we're not heading towards a contested election, you know, a hung jury, as they might say. At least now we know what the pieces are, and then we could play it accordingly.
You dropped a matter-of-fact comment in passing there, which is Russia is going to lose to win this war. The Ukraine is going to lose this war. And you said it in a very decisive way. And this has been my impression for months now, following your writing and some of the other non-mainstream commentators that have been following the collapse of the Ukrainian front lines time and time again, and high indices of desertion. How did we miss this? How has this been so underreported? I guess partly some corruption of mainstream media. But that's, I guess, a two-part question. How did we miss this in terms of the narrative? And then how dangerous is it that this might force an escalation from European NATO partners in trying to prevent Ukraine from losing?
I don't think they're in a position to escalate. I mean, so we wrote a piece at the beginning of the year called Mapping the War, where we addressed this very issue. Like, if all you did was read The Economist and listen to CNN and The Washington Post, you have a completely different worldview. And one of the challenges is sifting through propaganda, right? So we take pride in reading everybody's propaganda, because in there somewhere is an average that is very close to the objective truth. People swim in their own propaganda, and to think that we don't have propaganda here is quite naive, right? And so we set about the task of trying to find as many non-traditional sources of raw information. That's the great thing about Twitter, by the way. It's also the challenging thing about Twitter. There's still no better destination for a breaking story with where there's people with cameras around, right? But you can map the war. There's pro-Ukrainian mappers, and there's Russian mappers, and there's neutral mappers, and everybody has satellites, and everybody has sources, and it seems like all the soldiers are using Telegram and texting their friends where they are. It's a very bizarre war. It's the first internet war. You know, if the war in Iraq was sort of the first television war, this is the first internet war. So you can get an average. So the thing about when you have these sort of biased sources, they can't get too far out of line, because then people just stop believing them. And so you could get a pretty good average. Like, if the Deep State Project, which is a pro-Ukrainian mapping project, who admits that sometimes they don't update their maps because the Ukrainian defense industry doesn't want them to, if they're saying a town has fallen, for example, you could be pretty sure that that town has probably fallen. And they're using geolocations and AI to figure out precise movements. And like you said, Richard, like, if you follow this every day, as I've come to, just as a bit of a hobby, then you have, you're armed with this information, and then you read the Financial Times, or you read the New York Post, or you read Zero Hedge, and then all of a sudden you have like a bit of a, you know, you should do stock market research this way, right? You'd get your mosaic of information and come to something that is an objective enough truth that you can put money behind it if you're a portfolio manager like you, Richard, right? And so we're losing that war. Ukraine and the people of Ukraine are by far the biggest victims of this tragedy. We believe that wanton destruction of the Ukrainian electricity grid is tantamount to a war crime under Article 147 of the UN Charter. And I think, but they're going to do it anyway. And they're going to empty that country of people. It's going to cause a migration crisis in Europe. But to your question, like, what's NATO going to do about it? Are we prepared to have a nuclear war with Russia? Doesn't seem like the Pentagon is these days. And thank God. I mean, who wants a nuclear war? I think Trump's going to try to cut a deal.
Yeah,
we'll see.
You wrote about the BRICS summit that was held in Kazan that was led by Putin recently, and you talked about how, you know, there was some underwhelm there. Now that Trump's back, you know, heading back to the White House, what are your thoughts on the possible connections now and outcomes rather of Trump back in the White House, back in touch with Putin, and working out this deal that you, as you say?
So I think if you listen to Trump on the campaign trail, which we try to do on occasion, he prides himself on the fact that he had, quote, no wars during his term.
Yeah.
And he knows he only has one term left. He's not running again. And he probably has 2 years to make an impact. The big unknown for us is actually not Russia-Ukraine. Putin actually wants a deal. Russia has its own internal challenges. I don't think Ukraine will like the deal, by the way. And I think Putin's not going to stop until he gets the majority of the terms that he laid out Istanbul Plus, I believe is how the Russians frame it. The big unknown for us is Israel, Netanyahu, Iran. A lot of mixed messaging coming from Trump on that issue. Now, a lot of it was politics. You know, he really went after the Arab vote in Michigan, in southern Michigan, and looks like he may have pulled off Michigan by about that vote margin that they could have swung. So now that he's been elected, of course, you know, what you say on the campaign trail can change. Let's hope that there's de-escalation. You know, we wrote a pretty speculative piece on BRICS, as you mentioned. We kind of called our shot that Brazil might spoil the party. And I think the evidence is that we were pretty prescient on that call. It kind of came out of nowhere. We got a lot of heat when we published that piece because they thought it was conspiratorial and tinfoil. But, you know, sometimes even paranoids have enemies. But we also wrote about this Iran-Israel situation where we had a contrarian call that Israel would not attack Iranian oil and gas infrastructure, mostly because the display by the Iranians on October 1st reset the game theory of that situation, too. So let's see. Netanyahu's government is in a bit of turmoil right now. I noticed with some interest that he fired his defense minister yesterday, or the day before yesterday, I guess it was, just ahead of the U.S. election. That was an odd one. I know they had a lot of friction and not you know, a lot of acrimony between them, but we shall see. Let's hope that, you know, if he could strike a deal in the Middle East, I think it makes cutting a deal with Putin easier. The U.S. is stretched right now, right? I mean, yeah, we're very stretched, and we haven't even begun to talk about China and what the election means for Xi Jinping and the CCP and Taiwan, which we've written about recently as well, which is in a very, I noticed, great headline yesterday, you know, Taiwan semiconductor in big trouble because of the grid and energy issues, which we had called in our piece. So it great as in like interesting, not like great for Taiwan, don't get me wrong. So, I mean, there's so much, literally, like, this is the first, you're the first people we've talked to since the election. And so it's still like you just working it out. But if he could cut, honestly, if he could stop the war in the Middle East and stop the war in Ukraine, he win a Nobel Peace Prize. Not that they'd ever give it to him, but.
No chance.
I know, but I mean, he'd deserve it.
Yeah, I want to go one level deeper on this because on some level, Trump has has tapped into this desire, which seems to be a strong desire in the Republican base for no more wars, because it's the majority of the men that serve in the military service tend to be from these Republican states. So there might be an element to that. So there's this isolationist element. I'm wondering if the evidence that we have from his 4 years in office, he didn't start any new wars, but he also created this odd deterrence through unpredictability. I would point to the assassination of Soleimani in Iraq, the Iranian general, which took everyone by surprise. And I've also read about the Chinese military strategists hating the 4 years that he was in office because it kept them guessing, and then his unpredictable nature. Do you buy into that? Do you think that unpredictable nature plays an advantage on the geopolitical chessboard?
I think part of the unpredictability was driven by certain members of his team that Trump may have underestimated their real agendas in the first term, I think.
Like John Bolton?
Yeah, the John Boltons of the world. Much like today, by the way, like there is an unspoken civil war between the State Department and the Pentagon over Ukraine and over the Middle East. And all those people are going to get wiped out. Now, we'll be
more about that point, if you don't mind.
I think the State Department wants to escalate in Ukraine, wants to give Ukraine permission to use long-range ballistic missiles into Russia, and the Pentagon does not. I think Lloyd Austin has been the one that put the brakes on all of this. And when Zelensky came to the U.S. with his victory plan or his peace plan or whatever it's called now, I think he was rejected by the Pentagon. They can't fire these missiles without U.S. soldiers. The U.S. is not interested in getting into a direct, that would cross a very serious red line. And I think that we're not only do we not want it, we're not prepared for it. I think we've exhausted a lot of our artillery shells and missiles. And there's only so many long-range ballistic missiles the U.S. can make. China makes a lot of the critical materials for that now. And China and Russia, we've driven them much closer together. One of the big geopolitical failures of the war is the relationship between Russia, China, and India. Noted with interest that the probably the most important thing that came out of BRICS was the semi-detente between China and India about their border dispute, which we watch with some interest. So I think the Pentagon has said, we're going to take the L on Ukraine and we're going to trim our losses. Now, look, if you read Lloyd Austin's piece in Foreign Affairs or the Atlantic Council or wherever it was, he's not saying any of these things. But if you just look at what they're doing versus what they're saying, I think. And now, especially that we have a transition.
Watch their feet, not their mouths.
Exactly. And now that we have a transition to Trump, I think, look, it's possible that our geopolitical opponents try to take advantage of it. It's possible that the neocon element of Washington, which, by the way, is bipartisan, that Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, Nexus are all very much pro-war. It used to be, by the way, there was a comment earlier about no chance that Trump would get the Peace Prize. It used to be that being pro-peace and anti-war was a very liberal position. I don't know how it suddenly, fell out of favor. So we like to develop simple mental models, and they work for a while until they don't work. And for months, we have been analyzing the U.S. domestic political situation as pro-war, pro-peace, two camps. Who wants to go to war with Russia directly and who doesn't? Who wants to go to war against Iran? Who wants to go to war against China over Taiwan? Like, there are people in Washington who honestly believe that nobody ever punches back. It's amazing to me. So you count us unabashedly in the pro-peace camp, by the way. I mean, I have draft-eligible children, just for starters. And by the way, if we're going to go to war with Russia, shouldn't we have a debate about it in Congress and actually have a vote? It's bizarre to me. The weirdest thing, the thing that's really interesting is that they impeached Trump over Ukraine. Remember, one of the reasons he was impeached was over Ukraine. It's not like he doesn't know what's going on and what that situation is inside out after all this time. And I thought it was very interesting that Viktor Orban flew over to visit him in Mar-a-Lago. I think this is deeply bearish for the EU. It's just unabashedly bearish for the EU. We'll see who he nominates. Whether he falls for the John Bolton trick again the second time around will be very interesting. One of our recommendations, by the way, back to energy, if we publish this open letter, which we probably will tomorrow, is that he nominate Joe Manchin to be Secretary of Energy. I think that would be a brilliant choice on his part for that position. So we'll see. If he goes for the Manchins of the world, the practical people that are a bit, central in their thinking, centralist in their thinking, that's one thing. If he fills his, if Lindsey Graham gets to be nominated for the Secretary of State, then we have a whole different issue.
Yeah. You raised an interesting point about pro-war versus pro-peace. I was thinking through this current election as somewhat along those lines, but really establishment versus anti-establishment, right? And that ties into the neocons and the fact that Dick Cheney offered support.
I mean,
Kamala Harris was very telling about who in this race was willing to go the full length and the full distance against Russia and who would probably have an appetite to. And I wonder if that also plays into the two assassination attempts. But where we are in tinfoil hat territory.
Boy, think about how the world would be different, but for a quarter of an inch in Butler. It's pretty amazing to think about. In what universe does Dick Cheney think his endorsement of Harris was going to help her? I mean, on one side you have Dick Cheney, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton.
I thought it was amazing. I mean, I thought that Dick Cheney being the subject, of so much tin hat conspiracy talk in the past, I was surprised that Harris even decided to go along with that. It's got sort of all wrapped up with Liz Cheney and her movement, and then it just all got agglomerated, and then the only one to actually come out and say something about it was Trump. Say, are you kidding me? Right?
I suspect that Trump is much less naive about what he needs to do with his cabinet to achieve his agenda. Well, again, whether you agree with his agenda or not,
he's got all these people whispering in his ear anyway. It's not like he's coming up with these ideas all on his own.
Yeah. Right? Let's hope he reads Doomberg for energy. But we'll see. What would I be bearish or what would I be bullish? Like I'd want to be long anything Peter Thiel owns this morning. Like, I think he had a very good night. obviously Elon had a good night.
Yeah.
And I think, by the way, like the shrewdest move was Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post. I mean, I read a very interesting article by Pippa Malgram yesterday or the day before on Substack. She's a very interesting thinker. And she mentioned that Bezos has access to the best data system in the world through both Amazon and AWS and contacts within the deep state through the Washington Post. Like, he had to see this wave coming and got ahead of it shrewdly, much to the chagrin of, you know, most of the reporters there. So I think Bezos avoids a defeat, might not come out a winner. Probably not too happy about Elon Musk's coziness with Trump, given his competition in the space sector. But we'll see. It's just so many things to think about and to write about. Great. So, I mean, it's very bullish for content for us. That's for sure.
Yeah. Did you see, by the way, the I'm sure you did, the multimedia piece on Hainan?
I did not. Say more.
There was a full screen multimedia feature. It was Washington Post. In a very short span of time, they've built out a huge military presence on the island. And, you know, just 500 yards away from the resort areas where many Chinese tourists go for their holidays, mm-hmm. is the airfields, the military, you know, the military bases, the submarine complex, the submarine docking complexes, the dry docking. The entire island, in a very short span of time, has been developed, built out. They've carved out, you know, the sides of mountains on the island, of hillsides, to make way for the airport, the military airbase. It is reminiscent of the amount of work that's being done, you know, in real estate development, except that this was China's military industrial complex at work. And of course, Hainan is a launching point for the South China Sea and all the shipping lanes, and how vulnerable it makes the entire shipping business in that region.
Yeah, China operates at what we call China speed. And unless you've done business in and around China, that it's hard to actually understand just how quickly they get things done. And it's not surprising.
But it really exposed the extent to which China has built out this launching point into the...
Well, China wants to project power around its neighborhood. And they have their own version of the Monroe Doctrine. Also, look, the South China Sea is an energy-rich, oil and gas rich area. Malaysia is an energy superpower, for example, and China's short oil. You know, we did a full Doom Zoom Pro Talk on called The Year of the Dragon, China Through the Lens of Energy, where we talked about the South China Sea. And if, once you sort of look at the South China Sea and then map all of the oil and gas activity that's going on there, it becomes very apparent why the Chinese, who are deeply short oil, long refining, but short oil, might want to project a little power down there. And, there's going to be a multipolar world. I think China's an ascending superpower, and we should respect that. By the way, we got plenty to do in the Western Hemisphere. We got plenty of oil now. We're choking on natural gas. We don't need to be, getting entangled in all of these affairs. It's in nobody's interest that the shipping lanes get disrupted in the way that we've seen Red Sea, for example.
Yeah.
I think... The only thing on the board that we have no idea how it's going to go, I mean, lots of things we have no idea how it's going to go, but the one we're watching the closest that has the biggest impact that we can't say for sure what will happen is the Iran-Israel situation.
Right.
If that gets resolved, I think a lot of other dominoes fall. I think there's a deal to be made with the Chinese. There's a deal to be made with the Russians. There's a world where the U.S. has the Western Hemisphere as its main sphere of influence. And we produce more oil and gas and fertilizer and food and grains than any other part of the world. We have an economic boom. We continue to lead in AI. You have economic growth. We get immigration under control. You know, I think Trump's going to go for it. Whether he gets it is a whole different story. But I don't see that it's all that unnatural that China would want to project, you know, some national security interests and some economic interests. I mean, they play dirty. But like, we know how they play, and so, you know, act accordingly.
Well, in my sort of experience with understanding China, and it's not vast, but I think, you know, China has a long history of brinksmanship, you know, talking things up a lot, bringing things to a boiling point, and then backing off.
Yeah, they have some hard history. Like one of the things we forget is everybody's history, right? I mean, in Russia today, for example, World War II is the dominant cultural narrative, right? The Great Patriotic War. Well, China has a very long history as well. Japan, like World War II didn't start with Pearl Harbor, didn't start with the invasion of Poland by the Nazis. It started with the invasion of China by Japan.
Yeah.
And that was a very nasty war, right? And then they had the Civil War after that. And by the way, it wasn't always called Taiwan. It was called Formosa, and we almost invaded it.
In the century of humiliation before that,
yes,
has shaped the zeitgeist of Chinese policymakers.
Of course, just
the century where they're
and like we can't act as though a colonialism didn't exist. I mean, the global South remembers it, right? I mean, it like these people have cultural memories. They have that's why I read all their propaganda. Like, let's see what they're telling themselves. If for no other reason, it's an interesting data point. And so look, but the poppy wars, all of a sudden we have, you know, opiates coming in from China. Like this is the wheel is round on these histories. And it would be, look, I think we could all agree that the U.S. is not on the ascent in the same way that China is. Okay. How does that change our thinking? Look, I actually have a deeper philosophy on this, which is much of the current Atlanticist thinking of the US and the UK and the Atlantic Council and the neocons arose from and was formed during a time when the US believed peachy oil was real and that Hubbard's Peak was real, that the US and the UK were terminally short energy and needed to go around the world with a big military to find it. Those days are over. Let's change our worldview. We don't need to. We're swimming in cheap hydrocarbons. Let's change our worldview. We don't need to do that anymore. And I think peak cheap oil is a very dangerous myth that has shaped U.S. foreign policy with disastrous outcomes. I mean, our adventures in the Middle East aren't glorious. Like, name me a country that we regime changed that ended up more stable and not less when we were done. And so I think, you know, let's act like an energy superpower. Industrial might is a derivative of energy abundance. Let's rebuild domestic industry. I know I sound very isolationist. I am isolationist. I think the Department of Defense, their primary objective should be to defend. It's in the name.
You know, I all these insurrections into Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, these wars have just
Libya.
Libya. They've all led to further radicalization
and instability in those countries.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly make us popular in the global South, which is, again, the 7 billion people not living in the G7. Let's see what Trump does. But one of the reasons you don't get into wars is you might lose them. I mean, we've got a pretty strong track record of basically losing wars for the past few decades.
I'm curious, though, you've mentioned the Middle East situation a few times now. Would it be accurate to say that that is the flashpoint or the potential flashpoint when you think about the larger conflagration that might occur between Israel and Iran? Is that the one that worries you the most?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think you have Israel is it's underreported here, but Israel is suffering a fair bit of hardship, too. I know it is the subject of some serious accusations, you know, the United Nations resolutions passing with strong global support against Israel and so on. They're sort of they're under siege right now, as a site, economically, politically, geopolitically.
It's an existential fight.
It is an existential fight, for no question. How it ends is going to be very interesting to watch. I think that leak about Netanyahu and the ceasefire was very damaging to Netanyahu. We'll see. Look, the Israeli domestic politics is not a monolith either. I mean, they have a lot of strong polarity within their culture. It's a democracy. And we'll see. But if Trump can defuse that, then I think that opens the path for a lot of his other policies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I follow Israeli politics. I have family there. And one of the things I read recently was that the the political landscape there was shifting meaningfully away from left-right divide and more between those who serve and those who don't. And Netanyahu is only in power right now by this this mosaic, a weird coalition, strange bedfellows, and part of it being with the extreme right, the more religious part of the country that does not serve in the military. And that has created a lot of dissatisfaction with the average, more secular portion of the population that serves overwhelmingly in the army. And apparently the firing of Gallant yesterday had to do with his rejection of this bill that would keep the religious right from serving in the military. So there are all these consequences within the Israeli establishment right now. And it makes me wonder if the Dems are the party and they're still in power and they're the party that would perhaps back a more confrontational approach with Iran. We don't know where Trump really stands on this. It's a bit of a question mark, as you pointed out. Would that perhaps give this narrow window of time for the U.S., perhaps in combination with Israel, maybe on its own, to strike Iran? It seems like the Israeli strike recently has severely degraded their anti-aerial defenses. So maybe you can speak more to that.
So I'm not a military expert. I'll just say that up front. I have a slightly different view. I think the Iranian strike on October 1st exposed Israel in a way that is meaningful and existential. As we wrote in our piece, October Surprise, they have basically five power plants and five water treatment facilities that produce a great majority of their electricity and clean water. And that's 10 sites that everyone knows where they are. And if the Iron Dome is no longer as prolific as it once was thought to be, then that changes the game theory. I also have a different view about the U.S.'s position vis-a-vis this conflict. I think there are two factions in D.C. One of them wants to escalate in Ukraine and the other wants to escalate in Russia, in China. And neither want to escalate in the Middle East, except for a few people that have been, you know, anxious to go to war with Iran for a while. So actually, I think the State Department has been working very hard to achieve a ceasefire, to avoid escalation, to have a few, you know, demonstration missile attempts back and forth with the hope that after everyone sort of saves face, maybe we can step back from the abyss. So I don't think the Secretary of State, for example, or the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, I don't think that they're interested in a war with Iran at this time, not because they're peaceniks but because they would rather have wars elsewhere.
With Trump in the White House, I mean, do you see that Iran is back in the crosshairs? I mean, with priority over the Russia-Ukraine conflict, China?
So I think if we just sort of speak very crudely and broadly, Trump respects strongmen. So I think he's more inclined to cut a deal with a Putin or a Xi. Yeah. And he's very suspicious of people from the Middle East, is my guess. But I think, for example, like I think he and MBS will get along just fine because that's the kind of person that Trump gets along with. I think he'll try to cut a deal again with the North Koreans. But how he orients towards the mullahs of Iran is an open question. And that's the big unknown. That's why I don't know how Trump changes the Israel-Iran potential for escalation from afar. But the extent of the damage of Iranian air defense system, I think, is a subject of open debate, thick with propaganda. Let's put it that way.
There was a comment on CNN this morning that Netanyahu is most likely breathing a sigh of relief today because of the election, that he's been holding out on negotiations. He's been holding out on making any sort of a deal until he knew the election outcome. And of course, he too flew to Mar-a-Lago to see Trump recently. But does that signal, you know, other than the relationship, obviously, between Netanyahu and Trump, does that, you know, more favorable relationship between them versus the Biden White House?
Yeah.
Does that lead to something definitive happening between Trump and Netanyahu or U.S.-Israel relations in this, you know, U.S. getting more involved in resolving the conflict with Iran?
You know, I just don't know. Like, we weren't in the room, right? And I think, as I recall, at the end of Trump's first term, I thought he and Netanyahu weren't on necessarily the best terms. And so who knows? I think when you're politicking for an election, you make all manner of deals with people that you may or may not follow through with after you're sworn in. So I just don't know. My hope is that Trump is able to work with both sides and de-escalate. Look, in a world where a deal is cut for security in Eastern Europe that sort of minimizes the harm to Ukraine and takes into account Russia's strategic interests, where war is avoided in the Middle East, and we happily engage in a trade/economic war with China because we're competing in international trade, but we avoid a military conflict over Taiwan. I mean, who would be opposed to those things? Aside from a few people who, you know, like we said in one of our pieces, occipital region, when you're in the bomb-making business, peace is a working capital problem.
It's still not clear to me, though. I read your piece on the Israeli infrastructure vulnerabilities, and the takeaway there was that you were arguing that mutually assured destruction on some level. Iran doesn't necessarily have a nuclear bomb yet that we know. Israel does, but Iran can strike their infrastructure, so that would keep the conflict more in lukewarm and or perhaps even frozen. But that's you've argued that this is the flashpoint that concerns you the most. Maybe you can.
Sure. So we had four axioms to that piece. And that piece was a bit, again, it was a bit of a contra call, but, you know, we like to think axiomatically. So what are our assumptions? Then what conclusions flow from those assumptions? Then watch the news flow to see whether our assumptions were valid. And if they weren't, then we have to change the model, right? So the first is we assume that Israel's air defense system is no longer able to protect the country as comprehensively as they have done in the past. And I was watching videos on YouTube that night, and it sure looked to me like very powerful missiles were speeding into precisely targeted locations and blowing up with big booms. The second is that Iran has thousands of ballistic missiles left in its inventory. The third is that they have the capability to precisely hit targets with or without Russia's help, who knows? And then the fourth and most important one is that the Israeli leadership and generals understood this and will act accordingly. Look, if you only have 10 pieces of critical infrastructure, you're not going to stop 1,000 missiles, 100 going at each of those 10. That's the equivalent of a nuclear bomb for the people who live in Israel. So in a mutually assured destruction scenario, however unpleasant detente might be politically, it's usually the equilibrium state. Because brinksmanship, when the threat is existential, is different. And we like to say, for example, these comparisons of Putin to Hitler and Chamberlain, World War II. Look, if the British and the French and the Germans all had nuclear weapons, World War II would have turned out differently. Like, one of the reasons why you want nuclear weapons to not proliferate is because once a country becomes a nuclear power, you have to treat them differently.
Right.
That's why we're opposed to the development of nuclear weapons in Iran. Well, if they have created a synthetic nuclear bomb, basically, not with the same radioactive fallout, but with the same devastation to Israeli society, then maybe MAD is the equilibrium state and detente can be reached. Such situations are metastable, and provocateurs on both sides can often disrupt them and pull a few bricks from the bottom and cause the whole Jenga tower to collapse. But the equilibrium state in a MAD situation is detente, historically. It worked between the USSR and the USA for decades, right?
Right.
With a few near misses, underreported near misses that are now known to historians.
So that would argue then that perhaps this is the conflict that has the least, the smallest probability to actually escalate into a larger conflagration.
Well, the oil markets are certainly signaling that there's no geopolitical risk premium embedded in oil anymore. Markets can be wrong. I noticed some very tough talk coming out of Iran last week, which was a bit disturbing. I think many were hoping that the Israeli strike, however effective it was, might be sort of the end of the escalation. We'll see. I think President Trump's election changes things. How it changes things is going to be interesting to observe for sure.
Yeah. So I guess the one flashpoint or a potential geopolitical area of concern that we haven't really gone into much detail is China. I mean, we've talked about it a bit, but I'm reminded of something I read a while ago that Xi had reportedly told his military leaders to prepare for war by 2027. And that there's some demographic considerations, Chinese population aging, they wiped out 100 million of their population due to a miscounting. So a clerical error of 100 million in their population. It seems like the China has taken several measures over the last few years that would seem non-economic. I think Kyle Bass did a presentation in one of the DC think tanks a while back on how they were stockpiling and they were creating all these different redundancies in order to prepare for war. How closely have you looked at this? Does this give you pause and concern? Would that be the most critical place for us to focus on in the coming years?
Yeah, we did a piece recently called Indefensible, where we analyzed Taiwan through the lens of energy, and the numbers are really shocking. So Taiwan relied on fossil fuels for 91% of its primary energy needs in 2023, and 98% of those fossil fuels were imported. And they've shut down their nuclear power plants. They've gone full Germany on their nuclear reactors. And so they're extremely vulnerable now. And it's not surprising to us that, like, we don't think China is going to invade Taiwan for the same reasons why the U.S. didn't invade Formosa in World War II. It's tough. It's hilly terrain. There's only so many landing beaches and everybody knows where they are. And defenders in particular know where they are. And everyone's sights are already set for, you know, and it's a long strait, by the way. Like, it's not like you're not going to see them coming. I think that the Chinese naval blockade, drills were a message to the U.S. and Taiwan that we could choke your energy off. And if you'd like your semiconductor chips, you better come to the table and cut a deal with us on Taiwan. Now, there's another reason that the Chinese are going full speed ahead on trying to develop semiconductors and the U.S. is trying its level best to impede their development. It's because we need Taiwan. They produce basically all of the advanced semiconductor chips in the world. Like, there'd be no NVIDIA without, you know, TSMC. And they need energy to run those foundries. Like, those are energy hogs. And so they have 11 days of natural gas supply. It's crazy. And so it wouldn't take but 2 weeks to choke off Taiwan's energy. And having shut down all of their nuclear capacity, one more reactor left to go, what's the plan? You know, like, and so I don't think Taiwan needs to fight a war. Now they would have to probably fight a naval war with the U.S., who would probably try to break that blockade. But that would very quickly lead to a nuclear war. Again, China's a nuclear power, and you have to treat them differently. It's sort of our worldview. And when you read the full history of Taiwan and China, it's complicated. B, it is way more nuanced than it's often portrayed here. The people of Taiwan have polarized views on the matter. The last presidential election was closely fought. And it's in China's mind, you know, the civil war of the 1949 isn't over yet, in a way. In the same way that the Great Patriotic War defines Russian outlook, like catastrophic mistakes, like giving a literal Nazi a standing ovation in the Canadian Parliament, handed Putin such a public affairs win that you can't believe it. If you don't understand Chinese history and Taiwan's history, and you're Lindsey Graham on TV, you know, propagating for war, how those words are heard, like, that's a U.S. senator on American television. Like, if you read the Chinese propaganda and the Russian propaganda, they're already in World War III. You know, it's scary.
It is scary. I'm just befuddled, like, bewildered actually by what's going on in Germany. And now, you know, with your recent piece sort of exposing what's happening in Taiwan, energy wise, how, aside from the obvious politics and greening of energy policy, and of course, you know, their lived experiences with nuclear power facilities, or their fear of their, their lived experience. How is it possible that you could end up putting yourself in that state of vulnerability? Like Taiwan within 2 weeks could be out of energy. Germany is having an industrial slowdown because of its dependence on Russian energy stocks. How do you get yourself out of it now? Like, how do you?
I don't know. You know, like at least the Israelis are drilling for their own natural gas and built desalination plants, right? I mean, like,
how are Germans not pissed off about this?
Oh, I think they are, but you know,
voted for this.
Yeah, not really. You know, they voted for strange coalitions. So here's the thing: that the reason why we went down the Ukraine mapping project and to try to ascertain the military side of the war for ourselves is because it occurred to us that the same people who so bundled their energy policies are in charge of the military strategy. And why would we assume that just because they're wildly incompetent in the area we understand well, that they'd be even minimally competent in any of the other areas? I don't know how it could be, Pierre, that Taiwan is 98% dependent on imports, or that Germany shuts down, by the way, they shut down 6 nuclear reactors, or their last 3 nuclear reactors, after the war started, like in the middle of the energy crisis. Like, you get what you deserve at some point.
It just seems like in hindsight, the most obvious idiocy.
Yeah. So this is the inefficiency in the market that we have happily exploited, which is very few people understand energy and its critical role in the economy, in geopolitics, in wars, in life, and in death. Look, energy is life, and the absence of energy is death. Like, those are two axioms.
We only really feel it when there's an extended blackout.
Right. I wish you're coming, by the way. Yeah. So I think that the U.S., being a global energy gigapower, needs to reshape its foreign policy. We don't need to be entangled in the East. Let China figure that out. They're the ones who need that oil, not us. And by the way, energy drives everyone else's agenda. Again, this presentation we made on China, and then a recent piece on the Turkmenistan natural gas pipeline. It was called Plan D, I believe was the title of the piece. Like, China has a national strategy on energy that takes advantages of the things it has a lot of, coal, and makes deals with friends on things it needs, like oil and natural gas, and is building out a fleet of nuclear reactors like you wouldn't believe. And happy to sell us all the toys we need for wind and solar demonstration projects.
So while they're hamstringing us with wind and solar... and I enjoyed your storage units, your piece on titled Storage Units, which was, switching to, green has double the cost, because not only do you have this problem with intermittent power, you have to store it. So you need to buy the batteries.
Or keep natural gas power plants on standby, running at 15% capacity as peaker plants. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Generac is very happy with what's going on there. But
The main question is, how could it be that, especially Taiwan or New Zealand, like, these are islands. If you're a leader of an island, you have two missions: secure energy, secure food.
Yeah.
Everything else is secondary. Has to be secondary. Now, the fear of nuclear in Taiwan is unique and goes back to the days of the dictatorship, and the civilian Taiwanese nuclear development had a not-so-secret military component to it that was outrageous, outraged the U.S. and got them in hot water. And when they had their move to democracy, nuclear's brand was tied to the prior dictatorship. And so there's some cultural nuances and some history that needs to be understood. But their current situation is literally, as we titled the piece, indefensible. And it makes the island indefensible. When we cut oil off to Japan, we went to war. This is what happens. And so how it could be that the leaders of Germany or the prior leaders of New Zealand could think it wise to shut down your last refiner and then wonder why your main airport ran out of jet fuel. It's a long swim to Australia. and so, you know, I don't get it. But that those seemingly idiotic policies, to borrow your word, do exist is really bullish for Doomberg because it gives us lots of great stuff to write about.
Lots to talk about. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think this is... I straddle between malice and incompetence when I hear some of these inconsistent, ludicrous at times policies from these leaders, and I straddle between: is this just pure sheer incompetence? I mean, how could they be this incompetent? And then one thinks perhaps there's more to it than meets the eye, and we don't really know some things that could be happening. Do you have alternative explanations?
Yeah, I'm mostly in the incompetence camp at this point. I can tell you a personal story. It's kind of fun. We have time, right?
Yeah.
I remember when I was climbing the corporate ladder and when I would see what I thought were obviously dumb things coming out of the C-suite, then I thought to myself, you know, there must be some room where there's an oracle that knows more than I do that explains the deeper meaning here. And then one day I got to pitch the board of directors, which has to be the, you know, the inner oracle. And I remember leaving that meeting, and I could not have been more underwhelmed. I don't know how they got there, but it wasn't like some of them are great. Look, it's a bit unfair to say, but like you would be shocked at who is in charge and how they got there and what their skills actually are. It was kind of scary. I was like, wow, like. This is it. Like the level of questions, for example, forget what I was making a pitch about, but some large investment project that needed board approval and there was a technology component to it. And I was giving that part of the president, but the questions were just like deeply naive and scary. And then, you know, you look at the government. So now, like at least in corporate America, you get rich. Like if you're a board member of a Fortune 50, you're flying in on a private jet. Life's pretty good. Country club membership. If you're working for the government, until you reach that rotating door, I mean, who would go in government today? Like the personal destruction and the digging into your history and airing all of your dirty laundry during campaign. Like who would do that when you can make more money in the private sector and live a happy, quiet life? So then, when you get to the top of government, I always remember that first board meeting, and I always think to myself, like, don't like I'm in the incompetence camp. I mean, I know like there's sort of a tinfoil. There's, you know, the WEF and Davos crowd and all those things are real. They exist. Those are mostly just happy talk clubs. But mostly it's incompetence. Like, I don't think Olaf Scholz is a deep thinker. I don't think Boris Johnson is an intellect on the scale of prior British leaders like Winston Churchill, for example. They are who they are, like Justin Trudeau. It has a pedestrian intellect. Mm-hmm. Let's be very honest, right? He was born on third base and thought he hit a triple, and so that's who you have, right? And I think I think Justin Trudeau believes what he says, believes that he has the moral high ground and did all the right things during the COVID lockdown and. But it doesn't mean he's smart. And it doesn't mean he's capable. It doesn't mean that he would distill up in a merit-based competitive corporate environment. I'm in the incompetence camp, Richard.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, there are reports that Russia has financed a lot of propaganda in Germany towards the Green Movement and that sort of thing. But I guess those things impact on the margin. And
sure.
Not enough to really sway.
It's an easy boogeyman.
Yeah.
You know, if you had competent leaders, they wouldn't be submitting to Malthusian degrowth movements of the environmental left. So you have to be receptive to that message for external nefarious state actors to be able to exploit it. And so shame on us. We're doing that, by the way, in all their countries. I mean, this is what statecraft is these days.
Yeah.
That's
true. Yeah. I'm cognizant.
Go ahead, Richard. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm cognizant of time. And I did want to ask Doomberg to comment on the recent developments in Kazan, the BRICS meeting, the fact that Lula didn't show up. I read your piece on that, and that you
Lula hoops.
You speculated that this might be Brazil. I'm from Brazil originally, so I follow this somewhat, and I was curious to see this interpretation that Lula might be doing the U.S.'s bidding.
Yeah,
but I'm wondering now with the changes, the upcoming changes to the White House, does that then perhaps open up some space or at least a bit of a vacuum that allows the BRICS to flex their muscles?
Yeah, that's another interesting one. You know, I'm catching all your soft spots here today, Richard, aren't I? so the piece we wrote before Lula Hoops was called Neighborhood Watch. And that was the one where I think kind of out of nowhere, we predicted that Brazil would scuttle Kazan. We just sort of we enjoy a little pattern recognition and a bit of conspiratorial speculation. And we have to write 8 pieces a month. So you may as well put a few out there that are long shots. And in Neighborhood Watch, we hypothesized that the U.S. might be getting its act together in the Western Hemisphere. And we did an accounting of the countries in South and Latin America and where they stood on the BRICS spectrum, and more importantly, where they stood on the energy spectrum. And so you had the obvious ones like Argentina, very pro-U.S. now with Milei, huge shale resources hoping to be developed. You have Venezuela, clearly pro-BRICS. The U.S. is trying to execute a regime change there. You know, depending on your bias, either, you know, Maduro stole the election or the U.S. is trying to do another color revolution there. But they are sitting on the world's largest hydrocarbon resource base, and the U.S. is deeply interested in regaining access to those resources on their terms, of course. You have Guyana, you know, Team Exxon. Then you have Brazil. And Brazil is the largest oil and gas producer in the region, 4.5 million barrels a day, I think they're up to now. And they have a very analogous political situation to the U.S. You know, Lula is kind of their Biden, and there was a disputed election, and their Trump has been sort of cast to the let's not talk about these people part of the political spectrum. And so if you thought that basically Lula is close to the DNC, and he has a long history of close ties to the Democratic National Party, that maybe Lula's stated enthusiasm for developing alternatives to the U.S. dollar system, maybe he was playing a bit of a double agent role. And so we wrote that piece before any of this stuff happened. Mm-hmm. It's called Neighborhood Watch. And we got a lot of credit. Some pieces really provoke an amazing pushback, which is very interesting to us because it's a sort of a form of metadata. Then all of a sudden, you know, everyone from Brazil sends us this piece that Lula, you know, it has a brain aneurysm or some kind of a brain issue, and he's not going to go to Kazan. Well, okay, that was interesting. Had a bit of a Harry Reid, definitely heard himself exercising feel to it. and then Venezuela, Maduro is welcomed by Putin as a peer, you know, head of state at this big meeting with 30 some odd countries. And he's there to lobby for Venezuela's direct ascension into the BRICS, which would be a huge loss for the U.S. And who vetoes it? Lula. And then when you read the Kazan document, I know there's a lot of excitement about it. It really is kind of a giant nothing burger. Not really much in the way of action there. The word gold isn't mentioned in it, for example. And then they've agreed to study, to write a white paper. Always a great bureaucratic exercise in can kicking. And they're going to report back to the next president of BRICS, which is, Brazil. So, you know, we wrote Lula Hoops as sort of a victory lap on that prior call, which, again, is kind of fun to do. But I think, look, developing an alternative to the U.S. dollar system is always going to be hard. It's always going to take a long time. It's nobody wants to hold anybody else's currencies. It took forever to get the European Union up and running. It's going to take time. And, gold is well off its highs now since then. And we still own a lot of it, but not as much as we did heading into Kazan. I think if the U.S. is smart, it would focus south, not overseas. The Western Hemisphere is just so blessed with resources and opportunity and people to uplift from poverty. We can co-create value with our southern neighbors and share it. Like what a novel concept.
Yeah.
So I think that's the play. And I think now that Trump is in, how does that change relationship, you know, vis-a-vis Lula, Brazil, time will tell. You probably have more of a pulse on that, Richard, than I do.
Yeah, it's quite hard to read the tea leaves right now, I think, in the in Brazilian politics. So I wouldn't say I have very strong opinions in that regard.
Yeah, I would say Elon Musk's tactical victory of cozying up to Trump and Twitter X playing such an important role in Trump's election doesn't bode well for Lula and Brazil. You know, they had a little skirmish with the judge whose name escapes me.
Alexandre de Moraes, yeah, one of the Supreme Court justices.
That's yeah. So I think, you know, if you just look at it sort of playground fight dynamics, I mean, the ascent of Elon is bad for Lula. And I don't know, seem to be pretty straightforward, you know, level one analysis that explains 60% of the variance, let's say, and the other 40% you try to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, is the reluctance based on, you know, the history, the economic history between North and, you know, North-South relations?
Yeah, I mean, I think Henry Kissinger did a lot of damage in the region, if we're being honest, right? I mean, again, like we can't just assume that the rest of the world forgets what the CIA did.
1970s shaped democratic movements of the 80s and 90s in much of South America. Operation Condor, I think, was the name, where they overthrew Allende in Chile. They helped institute a military dictatorship in Argentina and Brazil as well. So those... that period really shaped the constitutions that were then written in the 80s and 90s. I know for a fact in Brazil that it did quite a bit, and that the democratic establishment was, especially the left of center, which was a good chunk of it coming out from a right-wing military dictatorship, but the center of Brazilian politics mm-hmm. definitely shifted to the left, and the anti-American sentiment, the animosity towards Washington was palpable for a number of years.
Yeah,
and still is.
This is why you read history, right?
Yeah, I mean, that would make it very hard, obviously, for a regional like a North South, you know, America's
right.
We
would have some trust to rebuild.
Yeah, there's some big hurdles there.
But if we were genuine, good faith actors and sophisticated diplomats, you know, and we defanged the IMF a little bit and stopped, you know, getting countries into debt traps and taking all their resources because of it as collateral, which, again, we're seeing the signs of that in Ukraine. But I don't expect that to happen, by the way. I'm saying that's what I would do. this is the policy that I would start with, a human first policy of American citizens, and assume that all of the other leaders of the countries we're dealing with have the same goal in mind for their citizens, and we would try to construct trade relationships that were mutually beneficial, and help lift as many people out of poverty. I look, rich, you know, very rich countries rarely go to war, right? I mean, like, the citizens of rich countries don't want to go to war. Well, the citizens of most countries don't want to go to war. Like, war is the ultimate failure of diplomacy. It just is. And so, like, I don't want to go to war. I like my house. I like my neighbors. I love my family. I don't want my son to be drafted into a military. I mean, what's going on right now in Ukraine is horrible. You wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Coming back to the BRICS and one of the agendas of the of this conference. I mean, was you said gold wasn't mentioned, but there is talk about using or forming a currency block, right? I mean, the challenge. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think you already mentioned that, but I think the idea of challenging, you know, the U.S. dominance as a reserve, as the reserve currency of the world, you know, the potential seizure of Russian gold might have triggered that. Is that right?
The seizure of their debt reserve assets, not their gold.
Sorry. Debt reserve assets.
Yeah, which were mostly denominated in euros because Putin thought he was insulating himself from such activity by selling off his treasuries, famously after the Crimea invasion of 2014. The unit, as they call it, which is an odd name for it, the rumors were that they would settle imbalances in international trade through a basket of currencies, 40% of which was backed by gold. That didn't happen. So what we're really talking about is the weaponization of the U.S. Treasury debt and the U.S. dollar system. And if U.S. Treasuries and Western European debt instruments are no longer neutral, they can't serve the role as neutral reserve assets, whereas gold can. And this is why we saw the run-up in gold, we many believe, right, because central banks were accumulating it. But there is no yet no workable system. Now, there's all manner of one-on-one deals. I suspect that the Chinese and the Saudis have cut such a deal, and that oil goes to China, a lot of goods come to Saudi Arabia, and imbalances get settled in gold. And I think Luke Groman's probably done the best job of chronicling this over the years, and the development of the Shanghai physical gold exchange window has really disrupted the gold markets. And frankly, I think the indebted nations of the West, if they just revalued gold at a high enough price, would their central bank balance sheets would look pretty good. You know, the euro is actually backed by gold, right? I mean, in a way, it's not like really publicized a lot, but they mark their gold to market every quarter. The U.S. hasn't marked its gold to market since the 1970s.
Right.
This fracturing of the Pax Americana and this idea of a multipolar world, obviously, the end of the U.S. dollar hegemony is one of the topics that is mostly commented on. But it is interesting to think the amount of outstanding debt globally that is denominated in U.S. dollars and the savings vehicles that exist in U.S. dollars vis-a-vis some of the other currencies. And obviously, you have raw materials and you have gold as an alternative, but not with enough liquidity and depth to absorb. So this seems like one of those, I think it's the Hemingway quote, how did you go broke? Gradually then suddenly, right? Mm-hmm. This seems like it's probably going to be a multi-year, perhaps multi-decade process. And this is just perhaps the opening salvo to that process, right? Do you expect this to move in any swift way?
I think that's right. I think there's one potential fly in the ointment that's difficult to model, which is the U.S. fiscal situation, which there's like no talk at all, except for maybe Elon fantasizing about taking the flamethrower to the U.S. government as he did out of necessity at Twitter. I don't think that'll happen, by the way. I think the hardest thing to do is to fire a federal employee. So nobody's talking really about reining in spending. Trump likes the numbers to go up. I think the long bond is, you know, rates are going to go higher. I think we are running basically what Groman again calls fiscal dominance, right? Like our interest payments are up to $1.2 trillion a year. We're borrowing $1 trillion every 85 days. The fiscal spending and what the Washington machine has just grown to 25 to 26% of U.S. GDP. It's the reason we're not in a recession, that and cheap energy. I don't see Trump's, like, the deficit went up with Trump, right? I mean, Trump was a big spender. Like Trump likes the numbers to go up.
It's a different issue.
Yes, of course. You know, everyone's got their wetting their beaks a little bit. And I don't see that ending. Trump is like, he didn't run on a campaign of smaller government, really. And he wants to extend his tax cuts, right? I mean, they expire in 2025. So that'll be the first big political win for Trump. Rich people don't want to pay taxes. And so he's going to cut taxes for the rich. And I think, how does this end? Like, this is the question, you know, like, Jim Grant Williams and his podcast partner, whose name escapes me, Bill Fleckenstein. Fleckenstein. Yeah. They have this great podcast called The Endgame. And right. I mean, at $1 trillion a quarter, yeah, like, I'm old enough to remember when $1 million was a lot of money. Right. It's still a lot of money to me, for the record. But like, you get the sense that appropriators in Congress wouldn't bend over to pick up $1 billion these days if it were lying on the floor of the House. The Department of Defense can't find $600 billion of assets or something. Well, crazy number.
I remember just, you know, the great financial crisis, that $700 billion TARP
the
deal
bazooka
was the biggest thing that had ever happened in financial, you know, financial history. And now that's like every week.
Yeah, it's truly.
Yeah.
So how does it end? You know, and we've, it's never really, we've never run the experiment. Oh, by the way, like a huge amount of that debt is denominated in short-term paper. Like that's emerging market stuff. We got to roll that paper over.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd watch the long bond. I'd watch, you know, watch the 10-year acting kind of like, I don't think you draw any conclusions from today. Like, I think you need to. It's
too soon. Yeah.
Repositioning. There's parts of portfolio repositioning, perhaps some stock. Sure. It's really hard to infer something on
day. Yeah. But like in a month from now, let's see where we are. But I don't know. It's the first time in history that I am aware of, at least, that the holder of the global reserve currency is hyperinflating. I mean, this is what we're doing. The rate at which we are printing new cash is consistent with the early days of Weimar. Now, there's a demand for that cash in ways that countries that aren't the reserve currency, you know, can't partake in. And so who knows? Like, maybe that's enough. But I don't know how it ends. It's really a fascinating situation. There's no line of sight to any fiscal discipline whatsoever, or even that the economy could withstand it at this point. Stocks have to keep going up. Money has to keep being printed. And we're all on this crazy ride together. This is why, by the way, we earn in fiat and save in real assets and invest privately where we can affect the outcome. Because, you know, the fiat isn't, I don't like to sit on a big pile of cash, you know. So.
And even if like Warren Buffett was given free reign trying to trim up government as much as possible, the fact of the matter is defense and entitlements are basically dominating the budget, which just sits at around 7% of GDP yearly deficit in peacetime with full employment.
Yeah, no recession in peacetime and booming stock markets. And we're still, you know, 7%, 8% of GDP as a deficit. Not debt, but like deficit. Like you're adding, I mean, when you're borrowing to pay interest, this is the definition.
That's fiscal dominance.
That's fiscal dominance, right? And by the way, like a lot of these entitlements are indexed to inflation, which is why many people think the government fibs on their inflation data. So I don't see the path out. Like none of the political choices are very palatable. And if anything, the last election in the U.S. and elections elsewhere in the world show that like the way to get elected to office is just to pander to special interests. So.
And with that cheery note, anything else on your mind, Pierre?
No, I think we covered a lot. I think we had a very comprehensive conversation. Doomberg, thank you so much. I mean, thank you very much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
That's right.
It's been a terrific conversation, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Absolutely. Anytime. I loved it. Find all our work at doomberg.com. Simple enough. And I really enjoyed it myself, Pierre and Richard, and looking forward to doing it again. Anytime you'll have us on, just send us a note.
Yeah, here. Echo Pierre's words. And conversations with you are always thought-provoking and enlightening. And I would point our listeners to Doomberg's work. It's phenomenal and won't regret it. So subscribe and thank you for listening.